Got a special episode on Sunday breaking down Game 7 of the Nuggets and Thunder series. But today, got Tom Havisham talking about Game 6 of that awesome, awesome series. And then everything else happening around the playoffs and a little bit of draft at the end as well, too. That's coming up right now with Tom Havisham. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We get a great one today with Tom Havisham. Tom, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How are you, Kev?
I'm doing excellent, man. I'm excited to talk playoffs. I was in Chicago all week at the draft combine. My brain and mind has been so focused on the draft, except at nighttime, well, it's come to been watching NBA playoff games, and we saw another good one last night on Thursday with the Nuggets beating the Thunder 119-107 to extend the series to a Game 7. We get the best Game 7, Tom, a Sunday afternoon Game 7. And honestly, man, this series deserves Game 7. Like, this has been epic. Are they going to give away MVP? We'll see. Maybe that'll set it up even more exciting. But I can't wait, Tom. I just want to start off saying I'm happy this series gets to Game 7.
Yeah, it is. It's weird that we haven't had the MVP ceremony yet, right? You got to believe that it's going to SGA on Sunday. They haven't released it yet. If it was going to Jokic, it would have happened already at Game 6 in Denver. But Max Kroos, I think it's pronounced Max Kroos, he is an online MVP tracker who has figured out a way to listen to all the podcasts out there, track all of the media reports, and he has basically figured out that SGA has 32 first place votes from the available media that has come out. And I think Jokic has something like 18 first place votes. So I think it's going to be Shea on Sunday. I'd be surprised if it isn't. But yeah, it's going to be a lot of importance, not just for legacy of Shea Gilgeous-Alexander and this Thunder team, but also Jokic hasn't been himself, his normal self in this series. He had a good Game 6, but I expect him with all that championship pedigree and the experience on the Denver side, this is going to be an epic Game 7.
Sure. And I mean, Jokic has not been himself for most of the series, but I do feel like he's trending up here. Turnovers in each game, 7, 6, 8, 2, 2, 1. So he's cut down dramatically on the turnovers he was having earlier in the series. He had 44 points on 17 of 25 in Game 5. Of course, Denver loses that game. Nobody else did anything besides the Joker. Game 6, he has 29 points on 9 of 14. So it feels like Jokic is figuring things out here. Is that your impression too, Tom, that Jokic is trending up? And what have you seen from him kind of bouncing back from some of those poor games in the middle of the series?
What's really interesting is that Jokic hasn't had big assist numbers in this series, but it's not necessarily because he's not passing the ball. Like, his potential assists are down slightly compared to the regular season. But more importantly, Denver's just not hitting the shots that they usually hit when they're set up by the Joker. If you look at the numbers, Joker is averaging about 14 potential assists per game, but they're only converting to 39% of those into assists. So he's actually getting a high number of potential assists. They're just not hitting those shots. And so those triple doubles that we normally would see from Jokic, he's not getting them because he's not getting as many dimes, but that's more on the player than it is about Jokic. What's more interesting about this to me is that Shea Gilgeous-Alexander actually has more potential assists in this series than Joker. He has the same problem on his hands where he doesn't have huge assist numbers, but OKC's role players just can't hit any of the shots. And we saw that in Game 6, where it was a lot of Julian Strother and Jamal Murray, Michael Porter Jr. hitting shots coming off of those passes from Joker, but not necessarily for SGA. In this series, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander has 18 potential assists and just 7 assists per game. 39% conversion rate. And so SGA is trying to get his teammates involved. Jokic trying to get his teammates involved. Not as much as in the regular season. But what I'm seeing from Jokic is a guy that's trying to figure out this OKC defense. They're throwing a bunch of different looks at him. They have a lot of length off the ball, trying to knock a lot of those cuts off the ball with Michael Porter Jr. and Christian Brown. He's not having an excellent series, but still good enough to take a team that won 68 games in the regular season and take them to seven games.
And of course, in that game six, it's the Julian Strother game. He, you know, has 15 points, a 4 of 8. He's playing big minutes in the fourth quarter. Christian Brown has 23 points, 8 of 14. When their role players are hitting, your young players are producing, of course, it's going to lead to more success for your team. And shout out to Calvin Booth. I mean, two of us draft picks stepping out big time in a huge game six at home. And I thought you said something interesting in there, Tom, how SGA has more potential assists than Jokic in the series. It's just like, as you said, OKC is not hitting threes. Denver, in this series, the zone defense they're playing, Steve Jones, who co-hosts the great NBA podcast, The Dunker Spot, he pointed out last night on social how the Nuggets in their zone defense, they brought Jokic a bit higher, so it started looking more like a 1-3-1 type of zone type of look sometimes when they were using it. In this series, you know, before the series, I had said how you're going to see Denver use a lot of zone. Early in the series, they didn't use it a lot. Game one, they had 11 zone possessions on defense. Game two, only 12 zone possessions. Since then, game three, 16, and then 45 in game four, 26 in game five, 23 possessions in game six. So it's ticked up throughout the series for Denver on the defensive end of the floor. And there, I wonder if we're going to see possibly even more of it in game seven, because versus the zone in the postseason, OKC is averaging only 0.91 points per play in the half court. Against man-to-man defense, 0.94 points per play. It's not a major difference, 0.94 to 0.91, but it's a difference nonetheless, and like every decimal matters here. And the big difference, though, is against the zone, OKC is taking 55% of their shots from three. That number is closer to around 40% of their shots from three against man-to-man. So if OKC is having a poor shooting night again in game seven, Tom, I think that means Denver's going to go more and more to that zone because you're controlling the types of shots you're forcing OKC to take. They become a shooting team. So that's something on my mind when it comes to what we're going to see in game seven.
Yeah, what are we going to get from Jalen Williams in this game seven? He needs to show up, man. Like, that talk game six is awful. Oh,
God.
Yeah.
He's been terrible.
Can't hit a shot. It was weird. Kev, like, did you see that play where it was that run out where he had, like, an open dunk and he couldn't get off the ground and he missed the dunk? And, like, yeah, he might have heard footsteps. I think it was Peyton Watson who was chasing him down. But it was just bizarre. He didn't have any of his legs, and he started out with two buckets to open the game, and then he was 1 of 13 the rest of the way. And that's the guy that they need to come up big in game seven, because a lot of that zone defense that disrupts the OKC offense, you're getting these like off-kilter, Jalen Williams having a very low percentage shots out there, all these leaners, floaters. But if he's not able to finish at the rim because he's just not as confident, or he doesn't have his legs, and he's not able to hit three-point shots, he's been cold this series from downtown, it's going to be over quickly for OKC. They need Jalen Williams, J-Dub, to perform in the fourth quarter like he was in the regular season and last year. He was their closer for much of the last 2 years in fourth quarters, just being electric. Kev, that hasn't happened much at all lately. I don't know what that's about, whether he's got some, you know, injury that he's trying to cover up for that we don't really know about. But that dunk, that missed dunk at the end, was bizarre. I haven't seen a guy that athletic and that young not be able to get off the ground in a big moment like that.
You know, Tom, I mean, like, missing shots is one thing, and the dunk play is just weird. Like you said, it just, stuff like that makes you wonder how much he's in his own head, how much of this is mental. And with J-Dub, like, the dude, I think he's a tremendous player. He's a great defensive player. He's super versatile. We see the role he plays throughout the entire regular season for OKC. But last year in the postseason, he did not meet expectations. In the NBA Cup, he did not produce at the level you expected. And it's happening again this series against the Nuggets. 16.5 points per game on 33.7% from the field, only 21% from three. The weird moments you're describing with, like, the missed dunk. With him, that's where you still wonder, is it this inexperience? Is he just not able to elevate his play? Is it something mental? But either way, like, this is it with OKC. Like, he just needs to be better. If Jalen Williams plays like he can and has during the regular season, then I like OKC's chances in a game seven. If he doesn't, it needs to be a monster SGA game. It needs to be a game where your role players are shooting the hell out of it. Or maybe Denver isn't. But J-Dub, obviously, goes without saying, dramatically increases OKC's chances. Who do you have, though, in this game seven, Tom? What's your prediction?
I think I still have the team that won 68 games. I'm going to go with OKC on their home floor. I think they do need to change a lineup decision here. I think Alex Caruso should be the starter in place of Lu Dort. He's been so good in this series. And considering he's got a lot more experience, you know, it was the bubble, but I think he's been the better player compared to he and Lu Dort. And I would suspect that with this game seven, you're going to need Alex Caruso on the floor for 35 minutes, if not 40 minutes. He's been that good in this series, that much of a disruptor. And I just like his leadership in a game seven like this, as opposed to Lu Dort, who's been kind of off. So I think when you're looking at a game seven, it's hard to bet against Jokic and Jamal Murray in this big spot. The fact of the matter is Jokic has as many game sevens in his entire career as Ben Simmons has had game ones. Yo, Ben Simmons has had seven game ones and Jokic has had seven game sevens. That's how crazy it is that Jokic continues to have these game sevens throughout his career. He already has more game sevens than Gilbert Arenas in his entire career, than Elton Brand his entire career. And I was referring to game ones. Gilbert Arenas has six game ones in his entire career. Elton Brand has six game ones in his entire career. Bernard King, six game ones in his entire career. And Jokic has more game sevens than those dudes. He is just, I don't know, it's something about this Denver Nuggets team that they want to play for game seven. I don't think it's going to be a great outcome for them. It looked like OKC was almost hoping to just like get back home, knowing they're at altitude, game six in Denver. It just seemed like they didn't have a lot of life to them. And the play that changed everything, third quarter, Jokic gets a block at the rim. Chet Holmgren gets an offensive rebound, the block at the rim, and then kicks it up to Jamal Murray, who lays it in. Jamal Murray, dude, game seven, like, I have a lot more confidence in Jamal Murray in a game seven than Jalen Williams, and that might decide this series.
I mean, Jamal Murray was sick in game six. If you get a healthier game seven Jamal Murray, you're right, Tom. It's hard to bet against Jamal Murray. I'm with you, though. I'm going to take the home team, the 68-win team, Oklahoma City. But who do you think the Wolves are rooting for in this series?
Ooh, good question. I think it's Denver. I think they want to see Denver. I think OKC.
Another Denver, Minnesota, Tim Conley versus former team.
Yeah, dude, that would be great. It'd be a really fun series from that standpoint. I think OKC is just, I can't imagine that the role players are not going to hit their shots just like they did against Denver. It's been a weird series for OKC, you know, with Hartenstein in the foul trouble and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in the foul trouble in game six. Very bizarre. They don't, like, all these things about how OKC has a lot of inexperience and they don't have that championship pedigree. It's showing in these moments a lot more than you'd expect. So Minnesota, I don't think they want to see OKC in this series, but I would suspect that Denver is going to have a lot to say about this. I think Denver is going to put up a good fight. If it gets clutch, I don't know. It's going to be hard to pick against Jokic and Murray in the clutch situation.
I mean, like, you do say it's been more than you expect, but they are one of the youngest teams in basketball, and they do have a young head coach. So, I mean, like, history does say that these things happen. Like, Dagnall's mistakes, coaching an end of games, SGA, that stupid foul that he had. Why was he even in the game in the first place? 2 minutes left with an opportunity to pick up his fourth foul. In some ways, you kind of expect it. So I'm going to pick OKC in the series because of my belief in them. But Denver does have the experience in a dramatic way over OKC in this moment. So we'll see there. The Wolves, they advance to the Western Conference Finals. They lose game one, and then they win four straight against the Warriors with Stephen Curry. And there's going to be no rest for their opponent here. because regardless of whether it's Denver or Oklahoma City, game one is Tuesday between Minnesota and their opponent. So no time off for either of those teams, whereas Minnesota is going to get some time to prepare. And I'll tell you what, Tom, Julius Randle, man, just absolutely sensational. In the closeout game, he had 29 points on 13 of 18 after a poor game one. 24 points on 10 of 17 in game two, 24 points on 10 of 23 in game three, 31 points on 11 of 21 in game four, and then the 29 points on 13 of 18 in game five. He shot 14 of 24 in the series when defended by Draymond Green, 7 of 13 in the series when defended by Jimmy Butler. Unstoppable. He was amazing. It's just unbelievable after what he did against the Knicks, after what he did for the Knicks in recent years. But this is the guy they hope to trade for, and here he is. He looks like a matchup problem regardless of what you do to him. He's been amazing.
Mea culpa. Like, I've been dogging this dude all season long, not thinking that he's the right piece in the Karl-Anthony Towns trade, that the Knicks won that thing 10 times over. Julius Randle in the big moments in the playoffs, I didn't believe it. Man, he has been awesome. The bully ball that he plays and the way that he's taking care of the ball, the mistakes that you typically see with Julius Randle trying to go one-on-three and taking all these tough shots at the expense of your team. He's been awesome. 25 points a game against the Warriors in that series. A 2-to-1 assist ratio, setting up his teammates. This is what you wanted to see. I will point out the fact that Karl-Anthony Towns in this series against the Boston Celtics has two assists. Okay, you think Julius Randle is a black hole and a guy who just shoots by himself and tries to take his team one on five? He is a much better distributor than what we've seen from Karl-Anthony Towns. And in that matchup that we might see in the NBA Finals, Julius Randle has been the better player in this postseason. No doubt about it.
Oh, yeah, he has. I mean, look, I'm talking about scoring here, but, you know, game by game, 6 assists, 11, 12, 13, 5. He averaged 7.4 assists in the entire series, so only 3.6 turnovers. He's been a great playmaker, secondary playmaker alongside Anthony Edwards. He has made good decisions on the floor. He's been dominant. And, like, you got to give the dude credit for embracing the role on that team. Like, I was the dude earlier in the season saying, oh, they should bring Randle off the bench. Wrong. Randle as the starter. It's the right decision. And they rolled with him, and it's working. And I think with Minnesota, regardless of the opponent next round, you got to be feeling good about the trend you've seen, I think, with Rudy Gobert in each of those first two series. Against the Lakers, I felt he wore them down game after game with the physicality. Then he has 27 and 24 in the closeout game against the Lakers. Against the Warriors, a much smaller team, of course. He doesn't have a 27 and 24 game, but I felt like that physicality over the course of the series throughout wore them down and was a big issue. And so if it's Denver against Jokic, of course, you know, that's the biggest challenge of all. Or it's against the front line with Hartenstein, Jalen Williams, Chet Holmgren. Rudy Gobert has come through throughout this entire postseason for Minnesota. So I think that's a good trend for them. And I think he can work in either of these series. It's not like he's going to get pulled out and, you know, going to see a Steph-like moment from a decade ago, however long ago it was at this point, Tom. Gobert's surviving, and he's thriving for Minnesota. Like, it's more than just Anthony Edwards is my point here. It's more than just Ant with Minnesota and why they're in this position right now.
Totally, totally. And I did not see this coming. You know, Julius Randle and Rudy Gobert, I did not love the fit, especially in the postseason when the game slows down. Can you get enough three-point shooting and spacing from Julius Randle to work next to Rudy Gobert? The answer is, so far, so good. And I think this is one of the questions that I have going forward against Denver. Can you get away with Rudy Gobert on the floor against Denver? You go with Naz Reid or Julius Randle on Jokic and then have Rudy Gobert off the ball. Or you put Rudy on Jokic, but that kind of, I don't love that matchup for Rudy Gobert and the strength of Jokic against him. It's going to be an interesting next series for Minnesota. The Warriors were not a good test for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Even without Steph Curry, we said on this show, they can win this series without without Stephen Curry in uniform. It would take Jimmy Butler to show up and be playoff Jimmy. We've talked about this. He did not show up at the end of that series. At this age, with the role players, they needed a lot more from Draymond and Jimmy. But you got to give the Minnesota defense a lot of credit, as they took them away and they were worn down a lot of because Rudy Gobert and Julius Randle just beat them up in that series. And I think a lot of the timidness of Jimmy Butler around the rim and Draymond playing basically at the three-point line for most of that series is because they didn't really want to get in the paint against Rudy Gobert for a lot of that series.
You mentioned Jimmy Butler, Tom. Let me talk about Jimmy Butler for a minute here. Jimmy Butler can't be trusted. 17 points, 4 of 11 in an elimination game. His last 11 elimination games, he's averaging 21 points on only 16.5 field goals per game. His teams are only 3-8 in those 11 elimination games. Too passive, scoring too inefficiently over these games. It's been over 2 years since Butler had that 42-point banger of a closeout game against the Bucks, the game after he had 56 against Milwaukee, and that was amazing. Those are the moments that earned him that playoff Jimmy nickname, as a guy who elevates his play in big moments. But the truth is that Butler has underwhelmed in these big moments more than he's dominated in them. And so let's go over the last 10 years, ever since he became an all-star for the first time. 2015, Bulls closeout game, 20 points, only 8 of 22. 2016, Bulls missed the playoffs. He played only 67 games, a trend with him. 2017, Bulls go up 2-0 over the Celtics. The remainder of the series, the Bulls lose four straight. He averages only 21 on 51.4% true shooting. 2018, he's in Minnesota now. Final playoff game in Minnesota, 8 points on 4 of 10. He also had games that series with only 13 points on 11 shots and 11 points on 6 shots before the 8-point 4 of 10 in the closeout game. 2019, now he's in Philly. His final playoff game in Philly. This is the Kawhi 4-bouncer. Mm-hmm. Amazing moment for the Toronto Raptors. Butler has 16 points on 5 of 14 in that game. 2020, the bubble. We're in Miami, of course. This is really where it started with Butler. Some epic performances all the way to the finals. This is where he started to earn playoff Jimmy. Only 12 points on 10 shots in the final game of the NBA Finals against the Lakers. 2021, first round, Heat losing a sweep, averages 14.5 points on 29.7% from the field, 19 of 64 in that sweep. 2022, he suffers a knee injury midway through the series. Injuries are a trend with him. He's amazing in game 6, 47 points. Amazing in game 7, 35 points. This is like peak Butler in the playoffs, and they lose, but he's dominant. He's unbelievable in 2022. 2023, again, great moments. Dominates the Bucks. As I said earlier, he has those unbelievable closeout games. But he besides, you know, pretty good game 1, game 2 against the Celtics, he wasn't great to finish them off. Wasn't great in the finals against Denver. 21 points on 5 of 18 against the Nuggets in the closeout game against Denver. That's his final playoff game for Miami, because in 2024, in the play-in, he has an ankle injury, misses the entire first round. And then, of course, here in 2025, he suffers the injury midway through the postseason, 17 points on 4 of 11. So you got Jimmy Butler, who's going to be 36 next season. And ever since he's been named a starter over a decade ago when he was with the Bulls, he's played only 77% of possible games. He's missed nearly a quarter of each season, averages 64 games a season, trending down to 60 games per season ever since he turned 30. He's always hurt, always disgruntled, and you're telling me the Warriors are going to bet on a player who misses about 20 games every year, has worn out his welcome with every team he's ever played for. They're going to bet on that guy to maximize the finals odds for Steph Curry and Draymond Green? I think it's foolish to trust Jimmy Butler, and by doing so, the Warriors are ignoring the mileage, ignoring the injuries, ignoring the drama, ignoring the declining ability, ignoring the reality that 17 points on 4 of 11 in a closeout game is closer to the norm in big moments for Jimmy Butler. And so this was the first sign for Stephen Curry, for Draymond Green, and the Warriors that playoff Jimmy's nothing more than a myth.
Tell us how you really feel, Kev. That was amazing.
Look, man.
It was incredible.
I'm just telling the truth, Tom. I'm just telling the truth.
Yeah.
This playoff Jimmy is a short window of time. A couple of series, a couple of games, and that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean,
and I feel bad. If you're going to trust him to be the guy who's going to help lift up Stephen Curry aging, hamstring injury, injuries become more common as you get older. If you're going to trust him as the guy to help lift Draymond Green with two guys who don't shoot, can't shoot, unwilling to shoot, I think it's going to be a gross end to this era. And that's sad to me.
Well, Kev, I think you lean on their record with a big three together. Right. And clearly, Jimmy Butler as the number one is not capable of having that responsibility anymore. In the last two games in this series, with the season on the line, he had a 16% usage rate in game four and a 16% usage rate in game five. That's a role player. In a games, these last two games of the season, they needed him to be an alpha, a guy who was a 30% usage rate like he was in game three. But in the last two games, a usage rate of 16%, which is like equivalent of like Moses Moody, like get out of here with that. That's not why the Warriors acquired him, right? They needed Jimmy Butler to be bigger in these moments, and he came up short. He just didn't have any sort of confidence around the rim, and it showed. I think he's a much better, as we talked about a lot, or he talked about a lot, Batman and Robin, like he's a much better Robin. And that's no shame in it. I understand what you're saying about the moniker of Playoff Jimmy. Yeah.
Is he even a Robin? I mean, let's just be honest.
If he's got Steph Curry, I think he is a lot better is suited for that role than he is as a Batman. But you're right.
Of course. Is he even a Robin? Is what I'm saying. Is he even a Robin? Like, or is he the third guy at this point? 36 years old, the injuries mounting up. Is he even a Robin? Is really my question, Tom. That's the way I feel about it with him.
It's fair. I mean, he looked great in game three, but $50 plus million
the next 2 years, like, gobbling up all that cap space? I don't know, man. I don't know.
If he is an amplifier, Steve Kerr likes to say that Andre Iguodala is the greatest amplifier that he's had on his team. Just a guy who makes everyone around him better, might not score 20 points a game, but both ends of the floor, makes the right pass, makes the right decisions, defends at a high level, great basketball IQ. He's going to amplify everyone around him. That's the mold of Jimmy Butler on the Warriors. It is not. The idea of him being Michael Jordan out there, he's more of a Scottie Pippen for this Warriors team. And at age 36, like you're pointing out, the chances of him being able to reach back and get that fountain of youth and be able to perform like Playoff Jimmy like he was a couple years ago. Look, his previous two runs, playoff runs in Miami, he was averaging 27 points per game. In 22 and in 23, he was averaging 27 in those playoff runs. I don't know if he can reach back and get those numbers again. And on this Warriors team with Stephen Curry, they might not need it, but certainly more than what he gave at the end of the season.
Yeah, look, man, I think for Golden State, we're seeing Shams, go on TV and say the Warriors are looking for a playmaking wing and a true center. It's like, good luck. I mean, I like the playmaking wing. How many of those are there? They're top 10, top 20 players in the NBA. And like, with what? Are you going to trade Jonathan Kuminga in a sign and trade? Well, then you need a team who wants Kuminga at 25, 30 million. Are you going to flip Butler? I can't imagine that. Butler also isn't trade eligible until August 6th because of the 2-year contract extension he signed. So for Golden State, man, look, I'm not going to sit here and say, told you so, because I was wrong. I mean, I was wrong to say they should blow it up because of the success they had. Like, they were very good after they got Jimmy Butler. But everything I was concerned about at the time, Tom, I do think was fair. I do think I was concerned about how this is an aging team and how aging teams' injuries start to happen. Hamstring injury for really the first time in Steph's career, that's concerning. Draymond Green, unable to stop Julius Randle. I mean, like, he wasn't even great in the series against Houston after an unbelievable game two or three against Alperen Şengün. After that, Şengün figured him out. Draymond is not the same guy he was before. Jimmy Butler is not the same guy he was 2+ years ago. Stephen Curry cannot be relied on to be the guy he was in the prime of his career either. And so I just, you know, seeing the story play out, like the comparison I had in that article I wrote back in January or February was about the early 10 Celtics when Danny Ainge traded Kevin Garnett, traded Paul Pierce right before they fell off a cliff. And it led to everything we've seen this last 10 years with the picks they got from the Nets. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, 10 straight playoff appearances. And obviously now Tatum's out with a ruptured Achilles, but it's been an amazing run for the Celtics. And that's all because of the decision to trade Pierce and Garnett. The hardest decision led to this amazing reward the last decade. And for the Warriors, my concern was extending this out leads to the opposite of that. And that is a lot of years of sadness. And we'll see. We'll see. They were very good to close the season. They made the second round of the playoffs. Maybe they beat Minnesota if Stephen Curry never gets hurt. And then they have a matchup in the Western Conference Finals against Denver or Oklahoma City. And who knows how that would have played out. Maybe it all would have led to a championship again anyway. I don't think so, though. And that's largely due to my skepticism based off of reality the last 10 years about the guy they chose in Jimmy Butler to be the guy to lift up and help lift up Stephen Curry and Draymond Green. So I just don't see it, Tom. And it's a big offseason for them, man. There are no signs. I'm hearing zip, zada, zilch that they're going to try to trade away these guys. They're going to double down on this. They're going to try to keep building it. I just don't know for who. But do you have anybody in mind like that you would target for the Warriors as somebody to help assist this core?
I mean, I know there was a lot of talk about Vooch at the deadline about
Vooch would step in.
But I'm saying if you're looking for a center and think he's on an expiring deal, would that be make
expiring
any sense?
With the Bulls?
Yeah. Josh Giddey, I'm just saying you need a playmaking wing.
Why are the Bulls trading Giddey?
I don't know. If you really believe in Jonathan Kuminga and the fact that he averaged like 30 points in the last three games of this series and he showed out,
the Kuminga truthers, like they are out loud and proud about Kuminga closing that series.
I don't know what. I don't think Joe Lacob is trading Kuminga. I think he has.
You really don't think so? You see the Lacob quote? Lacob was like, people say we had bad picks. They weren't bad picks. I was like, yeah, they were bad picks. They were whiffs.
You can't argue. James Wiseman at number two, you can't. And Moody and Kuminga, like if I looked up the hit rate on those, it's 0 for 3. It's 0 for 3. I mean, Kuminga, they can't rely on him in big playoff moments until they have to break the glass and bring out Kuminga, and then it's too late. Like, Steve Kerr had very little faith in Kuminga this season. And for you to say like, oh, he's young, he's coming into his own, we're okay. I don't know. If Steve Kerr is not really betting on this guy to play big minutes for a team that's trying to win, I don't think that can be considered a win. And James Wiseman, that was one of the worst picks I can remember a really good team making. They had such a great opportunity there at the number two slot, either trading it out. I remember I was advocating, I was like, trade out of that and get a guy like Pascal Siakam. And Warriors fans laughed at me. They're like, watch what happens when James Wiseman develops on this team. He is going to be a monster in this system. And obviously it didn't work out, but that's the kind of hype that you could have gotten at the number two slot in that draft. Instead, they drafted him, and then they were able to like get Kuminga and Moses Moody. And I don't think they've gotten much return at all with those picks.
I mean, in some regards, like not to, you know, rehash on James Wiseman as the 2020 selection, I understand the Warriors' idea of what they need next to Draymond, because Draymond should not be having to defend Alperen Şengün for a full series and Julius Randle for a full series and be the only guy they can rely on to defend these big, bruising, skilled players. Getting a big would make a lot of sense for Draymond's sake. And for the entire system's sake, if you give that guy to Stephen Curry in the half court as well on the offensive end. So Wiseman made sense. The idea of Wiseman made sense. The idea of Quentin Post makes sense as a big floor spacer who can, you know, offer theoretical size. But those are the right ideas, the wrong players. And like you're hearing, like you mentioned Vooch, he can't defend, but maybe for the Warriors, he can at least offer size. I hear people mention Brook Lopez. He just turned 37.
Yeah.
Brook Lopez is 37. Like, we're talking about Steph having hammy issues right now, Draymond going through stuff throughout the year, Jimmy Butler, who misses 20 games every year, and you're telling me Brook Lopez? Like, come on. Let's be serious. We don't want a retirement home here in Golden State. If you want to try to win, you got to look for other solutions here with your future picks. So, like, Miles Turner, are we sure he's going to leave Indiana? I know he's a free agent, but why would he leave the Pacers? They're their second straight Eastern Conference Finals. No signs of slowing down anytime soon with these young guys getting better every year. They could be here year in, year out. Why would Miles Turner leave the Pacers? Like, why?
There's zero reason. There's zero reason why he would leave. No. I mean, why would you go to the Western Conference when you're in the East and you have a potential to go to the NBA Finals?
No kidding.
And Giannis, he might go to the Western Conference. Like, if you're Indiana, anybody on Indiana, Miles Turner, I'm locking myself in long term with Indiana. Yes. You could be in the NBA Finals for like 3 years running just because there's no one else in the East.
Give me a 10-year contract. I know it's not allowed, but let's sign it under the table. Come on. I'll finish my career out here in the East and win every freaking year. I just don't see the obvious solutions for the Warriors, man. And I mean, I just look forward to seeing what they do, maybe more than any other team in the entire league this offseason because of the position.
Speaking of which, the Pacers, Tyrese Haliburton, mm-hmm. they could have had Tyrese Haliburton in the 2020 draft instead of James Wiseman. Boy. So,
God. I had Rafael Barlow, NBA draft analyst from NBA Big Board on the Substack earlier in the week, and we talked about missing on Haliburton. And it's like I pulled up my rankings for Haliburton prior to the draft. Like the first draft guide ranking I released, I had Haliburton third. And then it's like slowly but surely just ticked him down to like 10 where he ended up. And it's like, damn, dude, my gut was right initially. And sometimes you talk yourself out of guys, and that's what Golden State did. That's what a lot of these teams drafting in the top 10 did. They're like, this guy's funky, weird-looking game. There's no way he's going to be a primary creator in the NBA. And yet, here he is. The Pacers in a second straight Eastern Conference Finals. Will they face the Knicks? Will they face the Celtics minus Jason Tatum? Game six is on Friday night. And I'm fired up for this, man. I got some friends coming over to watch the game. It's a great Friday night. We're going to watch Celtics-Knicks. What's your prediction for this game, Tom? Because after game five, game five, there's some videos posted of the crowd. Boston crowds are never late arriving. But it was a late arriving crowd for game five, and understandably so. I'm sure some people decided not to go. They're like, Tatum's out. It's going to be miserable. And then the Celtics win. Derek White, bigger, higher usage, steps up big time. Peyton Pritchard playing more minutes, didn't have the biggest game, but he's capable of it. Jaylen Brown had a great game. And of course, Luke Kornet channeled the spirit of Bill Russell, and he had an unbelievable performance. So, like, there's a sense of optimism among Celtics fans that they can at least extend this to seven. Do you have belief in Boston to extend this to seven and possibly even win the series?
I think Boston wins the series. I think if they win, if they won the last game, if they win game five, I was like, yeah, this thing's over. The New York Knicks haven't won an elimination or a clinching game at Madison Square Garden since 1999. They are 0-4 since 2000 in potential clinching games at Madison Square Garden. Now, some of you are listening to this being like, how many are there? How many potential clinching games do they have in the postseason since 2000? It's only four. They're 0-4 in those situations. And over the majority of this series, Boston's been the better team. Of the two blowouts, it's been Boston blowing out the New York Knicks. And in this series, the Knicks are minus 35 in this series. In clutch time, the Knicks are outscoring the Celtics 32-12, which means outside of the final 5 minutes, game within five, Kev, the Boston Celtics have outscored the New York Knicks by 55. So they're down. The Celtics are down 3-2 going into Madison Square Garden. But over the length of this series, Boston's been the better team. Outside of some epic collapses at the end of these games that are crazy, crazy things we haven't seen in decades, the Celtics have been the better team. And Luke Kornet, the way that he played, filling in for Kristaps Porzingis, I think they're going to start Kornet. I think Porzingis can't play anymore. I think it's done. Whatever is ailing him this year, at the end of the year, I think it's at this point where you just pull the plug and say, look, figure out your health. Like, we got to just let this thing play out. And I know they tried to get him into the starting lineup to try to get some sort of maybe a different shift of, instead of him coming off the bench, getting him in the starting lineup. But man, Boston with Kornet and the way that he disrupted everything that the Knicks wanted to do around the paint, I just think Boston's figured something out here. And Jaylen Brown, when he leads the offense without Jason Tatum, this season, they're scoring 127 points. The Boston Celtics are scoring 127 points every 100 possessions when Jaylen Brown is on the floor without Jason Tatum. This entire season, over 800 minutes of track record here this season, they've almost scored 130 points every 100 possessions. Mm-hmm. In game five, that was at like 150 offensive rating without Jason Tatum on the floor, but with Jaylen Brown on the floor. I think Boston can score enough. And this Knicks offense has not been impressive. And I got to say, I think Boston wins this coming down 3-1, even without Jason Tatum.
If you have more confidence than I do, Tom, but I don't think any of your points are off at all. I think there's a real possibility here that the Celtics do end up winning this series. And on top of everything you're talking about, the game plan, the motion in that half-court offense, it's just looked like how it's supposed to look. It's how you expected it to look. It looked more like what it did against Dallas last year in the finals. And so if they replicate that in MSG tonight in game six, game seven Monday in Boston, gonna be a hostile environment for the Knicks. And you're right, the Celtics have been better than the Knicks throughout most of the series. I want to hold off on the talk about, well, what does Boston do this offseason? Because I think this series is not over yet. And I do think it's possible this series, depending on how it plays out, could dictate some of the things that they could decide to do this summer. Would you agree with that last thought there, though, that what happens against the Knicks may influence decisions like whether to explore a Jaylen Brown trade, for example, just one of those types of things?
I don't think they move Jaylen Brown. I think they're going to
Either way.
I don't think they move Jaylen Brown.
The thing, Tom. Here's the thing. We're
going to do the thing we weren't going to do?
Well, sure. Yes. Yes. Yep. Here's the thing. Fair. At the draft combine this week, Trey Johnson, who is a potential top five pick, Texas guard, he openly said the Celtics interviewed him. He said it on my podcast, and an interview will air probably next week. I have multiple sources telling me the Celtics also interviewed Cooper Flagg. Now, this does not mean they're going to trade up into the top 10, but I do think it's interesting, at least, the way it works at the draft combine. Teams can interview up to 13 players, and they rank the players that they most want to interview. This would mean that they had Cooper Flagg, Trey Johnson, guys like that ranked high to get the opportunity to interview them. And the Trey Johnson one in particular is interesting to me because, hey, like, he's one of the best shooters in the draft. He's going to go somewhere in like the 4 to 9 range. If Boston were to really retool this offseason, you know, Al Horford's going to be a free agent. Kristaps Porzingis is old. Drew Holiday is old. And Jaylen Brown's value may be as high as it has ever been. I just think it's interesting the Celtics have made it a point to interview these guys this week in Chicago. So just a thought there, Tom. That's all.
You know, like, the way you put it that way, it makes sense, because the only guy that you're going to trade Cooper Flagg or try to get move up to get Trey Johnson, it's Jaylen Brown. That's the only one that is going to have enough trade value. I know it's a big contract, but you look at what he did there in game five as the man, and he was a finals MVP last year. So I think a contending team can absolutely, whether it's Dallas trading Cooper Flagg for Jaylen Brown, I don't see that happening. But then again, Kyrie Irving is out for the majority of next season, if not the entire season, dealing with the ACL tear. But I don't see Dallas moving Cooper Flagg for a Jaylen Brown at that point. Like, if you have the opportunity to move Cooper Flagg, I don't think it's going to be for Jaylen Brown. I don't, even though he's
what if Cooper pulls an Eli Manning? He says, "I'll only go to Boston." Oh my God. Hometown New England boy.
Can you imagine? He didn't look super thrilled on draft lottery night. I mean, he wasn't like...
Did you see his face when the Sixers moved up into the top four? It was like joy. And then when Dallas got number one, it was like,
Can we talk about that real quick? It's like, I don't think if you're Cooper Flagg, you want to be in that situation. Like, that seems like a lot of pressure, given that you're stepping in the wake of the most controversial, worst trade in NBA history in Luka Doncic for Anthony Davis. And if you're stepping into that situation, man, you've got so much accountability and responsibility to pull through for the Dallas Mavericks. That's a lot of pressure. That is the winningest team to land the number one overall pick since 1993 when Orlando got Chris Webber after getting Shaq. Like, 39, a 500 team and playing in the play-in. Like, those teams usually don't make it into the number one overall pick. And so Cooper Flagg is joining a team that he really has to show out, because the fans are already at the neck for Nico Harrison for trading Luka Doncic. So if Cooper Flagg comes out flat, that's really, really tough. So I can understand why he wouldn't want that kind of pressure coming into that situation. And yes, they have ready-made talent around him that he can win right away. That also means that there's a lot of expectation for the Dallas Mavericks next season with Anthony Davis, PJ Washington, Najee Marshall, Klay Thompson. They're not waiting for Cooper Flagg to develop. They want to win right now, and so does Nico Harrison, who's fighting for his job.
Boston calls Nico, and they offer Jaylen Brown, and how many first-round picks is it going to take, Nico? I wonder if Dallas and their entire decision-making unit would listen. I just wonder. I wonder, Tom.
Yeah, well, you don't have to wonder, because they already traded Luka Doncic for 50 cents on the dollar. So they would probably listen to that, you know?
It doesn't take a lot of first round picks. I'm sure Nico would listen, but would Dumont and Welts and some of the other powers that be now in Dallas, who have kind of realized, okay, we made a mistake here, are they going to listen?
Yeah.
And I think to your point, Tom, for Dallas, if they are indeed all about winning the championship the next year or two, does Cooper actually help you win the championship in the next year or two? Like, that's a fair question. It's a strange fit. Like, Cooper can fit anywhere and thrive in any role, but playing the three for a lot of minutes next to Anthony Davis, who wants to be a four, and Derek Lively or Daniel Gafford at the five, that's not the ideal fit for Cooper Flagg. So it's not great for him, because of all the reasons you're talking about on court and off court. But for Dallas also, is that really the championship ingredient that you're missing? I'm not so sure about that. I'm really not.
Yeah, I mean, the pitch would be you getting a finals MVP. How often are finals MVPs on the market that you can go trade for that guy? I mean, I don't think that Jaylen Brown is that caliber of player. He's not a perennial all-NBA player. He's not a top 15 player in my book. But if you're Nico Harrison and you're looking at the possibility of adding Jaylen Brown to your team, 28 years old, in his prime, I wouldn't give up Cooper Flagg. If it was a down year in the draft, maybe you give up the number one overall pick. If it's Zachary Risacher, for example, if it's that year, yeah, I think you're deciding, okay, I'm willing to trade the number one overall pick if it's Zachary Risacher for Jaylen Brown, but not when it's Cooper Flagg. I don't see it happening, but then again, we're talking about Nico Harrison, who has time and time again made very controversial trades that people doubted at first. But if Cooper Flagg somehow forces his way to Boston, my God, like, that arena. I mean, New England itself, how amazing would that be for the Boston faithful to get Cooper Flagg coming home to Boston and being under those championship banners? Can you imagine, dude? Like, that would be nuts.
I know that's what his family would want. That's for damn sure. So we'll see. We'll see. Highly unlikely, but this is the time to speculate in the weeks ahead leading up to the draft. Until we get rock solid 100%, Cooper's going to Dallas. Nothing's going to happen. No Giannis fantasy. No forced, destinations. Like, he wants to go to San Antonio instead, or whatever it might be. Or Boston fantasy. Until we know for certain, considering we just saw them trade Luka a couple months ago, Tom, I think it's fair to wonder about what the hell is going to happen with one, not just two, not just three, because San Antonio could trade out, down, up, and Philly at three. Who knows what they're going to do as well. So, Tom, we got a game seven coming up on Sunday. We might have a game seven on Monday. Game one of Pacers versus Knicks or Celtics won't be until next Wednesday. So they get a little bit of time here. But, Tom, thanks for joining me this week, man. I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Man, I'm just sitting here just kind of thinking about Cooper Flagg somehow. I mean, they did get Jason Tatum on a draft night trade. So it wouldn't be super crazy, but man, I'm just trying to wrap my head around that. Dude, it's been great. You know, we did the show after draft lottery earlier in this week, and I never thought that Nico would trade out of number one. And then you get the ESPN report from Tim McMahon saying they're going to take Cooper Flagg. All expectations are going to take Cooper Flagg. But the more that this drags out, Kev, I'm with you. I wonder if the Dallas Mavericks, the offers are going to be there. The offers are going to be there for Cooper Flagg. And I just don't know. As time goes on, I'm warming up more to the idea that they move Cooper Flagg. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but
they should go the other way. They should take Cooper and trade AD. That's what they should do, is they should start reset, have a young team. That's what they should do. And I don't know exactly if that's what they're going to do, though. But Tom, we'll talk again next week. Thanks for joining me, man. We got a Sunday live show after game seven between the Nuggets and the Thunder. Will be live on Sunday on Yahoo Sports, YouTube, X, Facebook. You can watch it all there. So stay tuned for that. I'm looking forward to it. And thanks to Mike and Emmy for producing us. Have a great rest of your weekend, everybody.